What I would like to suggest, given the number of questions that James' presentation brings to bear, is we take the first 5 minutes of the Q&A and perhaps let the panelists tackle some of them and then open it up to the floor, if that's okay. And I'd also like to point out in the agenda that after this Ebola-specific discussion section, there'll be a break and there'll be another opportunity. There's going to be a roundtable discussion, so there'll be other opportunities to address some of the broader themes that have emerged today. So we will get to that. Would any of the other speakers like to elaborate on any thoughts that address some of the questions James just asked?
I should have taken notes.
Or we can go back to Avian
influenza.
There's
so many questions. I could start on a few of them.
Well, I could ask. Do we have any? How much evidence do we have of what percentage of apes with Ebola catch Ebola from other apes, and what percentage catch it from some other reservoir? And so, whether some kind of barrier to ape dispersal, whether it's vaccinating apes or whether it's river clearance, could actually make a difference as a barrier to Ebola spread.
We had a meeting at the beginning of this month in Paris, and Eric Leroy was here again, and he gave more information compared to the paper of 2003. He has now more sample from gorilla, thanks to the work of WVCS in Congo, and so far he never found the same strain in all the gorilla strain that he has so far, including, he said to us, they found several gorilla in a clearing, so two of them were from the same family, and the strain of the two were different. So this again give fuel to the his thinking, his thought, that probably the spread in the ape population is not first that easy. Because of the behavior of the gorilla or the chimpanzee, for example. But also, this last finding gives fuel to the fact that probably gorilla infected from another source and not within the population. Also, you have to keep in mind that during the Minkebe outbreak in Gabon, we have an outbreak in Minkebe, Andok, and Minkuka. In fact, it was not one outbreak, but three introduction of the virus in the population. And this outbreak were preceded by a die-off of gorilla and chimpanzee in Gabon. And it was an outbreak in gorilla and chimpanzee going along a river called the Nuna River. And again, the rapidity of the spread, if it was just spreading in the population, do not fit with what we know of the behavior of the apes. And this is also another information. This was not published, what I just tell you. It was not yet published, I will say. But this also gives fuel that the spread in the ape population cannot explain the rapidity of the spread in the wild today.
And then I would also add that we do have very limited information to work with. But in the Ebola outbreak in the Ivory Coast with chimpanzees, which tend to show a lot more grooming behavior between individuals in a group than lowland gorillas tend to do. And the chimpanzees, the animals that died, there were survivors in family groups and fatalities. And when they looked at the behavior, there was no relationship with grooming behavior between the individuals. But the chimps that died were a high correlation with hunting behavior. So it looked like all of those chimps were individually infected, and even though they're grooming each other, the other family members. And there's some new data that's also unpublished showing over a 20-year span of looking at primates throughout the region, they're picking up serological evidence of exposure to Ebola in different primate populations all across that map, on both sides of all the rivers, with chimpanzees, interestingly, having about 10 or 11% exposure rates, which means they were exposed, possibly infected, and also survived. question that I was hoping you would also bring up was, you know, does it matter? Because I think that's what happens a lot with wildlife health issues. And traditionally, when wildlife populations were extremely robust and recovered easily, wildlife disease was seen as a natural event and a good thing. And it kept populations modulated. Now we have the limited opportunity for populations to recover, but also it's interesting, as you mentioned, as James mentioned with the Walsh work, was you're seeing Ebola where gorillas are extremely high densities, like record high densities, not seen anywhere else. So you kind of imagine this urban environment with people really crowded together, and you have a disease outbreak, and the populations go back down to something that's kind of more normal, which is a horrible way to think about gorillas for me. But you start to wonder, what's it mean? And that's great as long as there's still hundreds of thousands of gorillas, we'll still have a species that won't go extinct. But if we don't, you know, that half, the other half being killed by poaching and hunting, maybe that's the thing that breaks the camel's back.
Well, of course, not being an ecologist, I might not be able to answer to that question. But it does bring to mind a speculation as to the mutagenicity of the virus. Because when you compare, for instance, to HIV, which takes a lot of time to kill people, once the AIDS status is reached, you have like 10 to 15% of the viruses that are mutated. And so it is interesting to compare that with the Ebola situation, where when we look at Leroy's paper, it looks like there's not so much mutation. However, the remark by Pierre earlier suggests that within a group of infected gorillas, there's no ape-to-ape transmission apparently, but the reservoir seems to be able to give each and every one of them a different strain of virus, suggesting that within the reservoir there might be some kind of mutation going on. Not too much, as in HIV, but still interesting enough. But it does matter, of course, in terms of design of vaccines and antiretroviral drugs, because if we have mutants that are resistant, then we're in trouble again.
May I make a comment? Well, I would like also to make a comment on the use of vaccine in the wild. You have to keep in mind that all the vaccines that have been developed so far are what we call the modified organism. So they are vectors where you put something else. So are you people in charge of conservation going to put this kind of vaccine in the wild tomorrow? This is a question.
For the audience, it gets into the issue of genetically modified organisms. So we could potentially test this vaccine in humans, and it's been tested in macaques, Asian monkeys, which aren't in Africa, seem very safe. We haven't tested in humans yet. We have not tested in great apes. We don't know what that means if you let that mutated genetic material go into the wild, that, you know, there could be unintended consequences. Maybe it's lethal for elephants, we don't know, but if you have these organisms that you're spreading, so it does get tricky.
But I
do want to go on record, before we go too far, is saying the answer to the question is ape-to-ape transmission versus some mysterious reservoir, we think it's probably bats, and other animals maybe going to apes, which is more important, which is, I think, the prime question. And we don't have the answer to which is more important. But I do feel like both are happening. I truly believe there has to be some ape-to-ape transmission because they're so similar to humans. And in humans, there's human-to-human transmission. So I can't imagine that's not possible. And we also know there's multiple outbreaks or spillover events from reservoirs. So I think the answer is something in between, but I don't know where to balance which is more important.
Just to give some sure of what you said, I have worked in in Thai forest during 5 years with Christophe Busch following the community of chimpanzee in Thai. And during the outbreak of Ebola, we have shown that, in fact, the positive chimpanzee was in fact a young chimpanzee of 2 years old that probably acquired the disease with his mother because he was breastfeeding. So this is at least one transmission in the wild.
Is anybody thinking about the possibility of doing clinical trials on, or at least safety trials on apes of the vaccine candidate?
Yeah, we've discussed that with the vaccine developers now. And I think the best people, vaccinologists, scientists that develop vaccines, are very careful about using good science to show how their vaccine works. And the people, the private industry side that's developing the vaccine, is currently on a very tight timeline to meet their investors' expectations of delivering a product that goes public and makes money on a certain time frame. So there's the business side of this vaccine development. So we've talked to about trying it in some great apes, like next week would be fine with me. But they say, no, that distracts their production lines, and they can't afford, what if we give it to an ape and the ape dies and it raises all these flags for all they've gotten millions of dollars invested in the production of this, and it just shelves the whole thing. So they're very nervous about us using it differently until it's tested in humans. At that point, they're happy. And I think there's some gorilla orphanages, zoos, laboratories that will be a great first place to test it in great apes, because they're there and they're controlled, versus darting a great ape in the wild or tossing them a banana and having them laugh at you, I guess. But we could maybe dart them. And then trying to do a follow-up in a month and see if it really worked. So I think we'll start in a zoo or laboratory setting, and if it's got it. But it's probably 2 years out from now. We're talking about 2006 that they will probably give it to us to use.
I'm just going to throw out a few outstanding points and then open this up to the audience. If it comes up, we might want to talk about the practicalities of vaccinating great apes in the wild, which Billy was just alluding to. We also might want to look at what we do have data-wise in terms of whether we've got Ebola on both sides of many of the major river systems already, which is an important question in terms of whether you want to even look at those barrier issues when we might also have a flying vector. And thirdly, when we work in wildlife health, when we're intervening, for those of you who aren't primarily involved in this, we're often intervening in cases where we have an alien invasive disease. That is a disease that doesn't belong in an ecosystem. A good example is brucellosis in Yellowstone or tuberculosis in Kruger National Park. These are diseases that people brought in, usually with their livestock. And so you can imagine sort of from an ethical point of view, it might make sense to try and return that system to a natural state. Personally, I think it's a valid question when we have a disease like Ebola that seems to be endemic, native to this part of the world. It opens up broader questions about intervention, which need to be balanced with the realities of the highly endangered status of the great apes we're talking about. So I'll just throw those things out there, and we'll start to take questions. Yes, up front here.
Wait, can I get you on?
Yeah. Angela's right here.
Is it on? I have a question regarding the river clearance idea. Has anyone thought of the potential ramifications of further fragmenting the populations in terms of risking losing genetic diversity, especially in a species that is at threat of a disease already?
I think it's widely recognized that is a problem. I think it's also thought that in animals with a generation time of 20 or 30 years, setting up geographical barriers that are only going to last 2 or 3 is unlikely to be terribly disastrous, and we could see where we are in 5 years.
It's been a fascinating experience for me over the last few years, because not all ecologists are built alike. So generally the field of a lot of conservation, well, a lot of conservation actually came from managing wildlife for hunting, the origins. A lot now is very involved with ecological basis for maintaining ecosystem integrity. And then you have this outlier group that are really interested in charismatic megavertebrates. So people who study gorillas, orangutans, chimpanzees, whales, and that's a different kind of class of thinking in wildlife. So if duikers are dying, you know, it's part of the ecosystem, and those are really important things, and if it's a gorilla dying, you know, burn the forest to protect them. And it's all about our human nature and our value systems, and it's a really interesting question, and it deserves further debate about our human, you know, we're putting our psychological, our value systems into ecosystems.
I had a question regarding the Ebola outbreaks and their impacts on apes. Neither the virus or the trade in bushmeat, or the use of consumption of bushmeat, or the logging trade are new within certainly the last few decades. What do we think may have prompted the change? Was it simply chance, or might there have been some other factor, such as civil unrest or disintegration of civil infrastructure in some of these cases that may have accelerated the process of this disease emergence?
I would start up. I would say we're also biased by our ability to observe. So my first guess is there have been a lot of Ebola outbreaks for centuries in remote places that we didn't hear about, and villagers didn't make it very far before they died. So I think some of it is our sensitivity, our ability to pick up on, I think, missionary hospitals, the spread of healthcare in. Maybe help detect some of these things? I would start with that point.
Yeah, well, I guess, I mean, the bushmeat trade is bigger than it was a decade ago. I am not from the conservation sector, but this is my feeling. Second, there is not only Ebola as an infectious disease probably in the tropical forest of Central Africa. There is other infectious disease also that can cause deadly infection. We have witnessed in Côte d'Ivoire, for example, an outbreak of Streptococcus pneumoniae within a community of chimpanzees that was killing 25 to 30% of the mortality rate. So it's very important, it's as high important as the Ebola. And this one was introduced probably by the villagers and the scientists coming in the forest. In Thai, they have also investigated an outbreak of anthrax in chimpanzees. So there is not only Ebola, but other disease going in the forest. Because I think also these last 5-10 years, we have had a lot of people investigating all that and monitoring all that. So that we have more information of what is happening there. But like says Billy, for example, we have reports in 1994 of pygmy villages north of Maibut who completely disappeared after outbreak of deadly disease was never investigated. We have the number of cases. We have never been able to have any sample, but it was after the pygmy finding dead gorilla in the forest that all the village disappeared. So it's not that simple, the answer to your question. For me, there is something new, probably, that we cannot explain so far today, to see how it seems to move now from west to east and to go through Otara National Park and probably is going to go north now. This I cannot explain today.
I was going to ask about that. So would that suggest to you that there's an ongoing epidemic probably in something other than apes, in some kind of other terrestrial vertebrate or some other animal which has a limited dispersal capability, and so you do have a movement of an epidemic in that direction?
Yeah, it looks like. So, well, from the data that we have, and of course we have limited, still we have limited data, but we have enough data to understand that something is moving. We are not talking about spirit, but something is moving in the forest, carrying the virus. I don't know if it's an octopus.
Show me the evidence.
And it's probably not the fruit bats, but this, by, for me, by themselves, because if fruit bats were really the true reservoir, we would have much more introduction of the virus in the population, like we have for other bat viruses, like Nipah or Hendra in Asia. So it doesn't fit with bat being the reservoir, for me, but maybe I'm wrong.
And I'm getting the signal that that's all the time we have for this Q&A. Bob's going to make some announcements, and I think we, if in the final panel discussion, we may have an opportunity to revisit some of these issues.